Great to have you with us on the Ideas Network. Larry Mueller here. Well, I'm wondering if you've heard about the murder hornets. We'll be talking about that with PJ Leash back with us once again. He manages the UW-Madison Insect Diagnostic Lab, has degrees in biological sciences and entomology. He'll talk about those large hornets and also take your bug-related questions. So I hope you'll give us a call at 800-642-1234, or you can send us an email to ideas@wpr.org, and we'd love to hear from you. And PJ Leash, welcome. Nice to have you with us again.
Yeah, glad to be back on with you, Larry.
Well, let's talk about, we did talk about this a little last year, but remind us why the Asian giant hornet is creating such a stir.
Well, it's really interesting. I think part of the situation is simply that we saw this flurry of news articles about it, and especially some of them that we were referring to this particular insect as a murder hornet drew a lot of attention. There is a New York Times article in particular that really made the rounds on social media. And when you throw out terms like murder hornet out there, it's just going to catch people's attention.
Well, how are they different from other hornets?
Well, the first thing off the bat is that they're big. The queens, for example, can be about an inch and a half long, maybe pushing 2 inches. That's about as big as they get. They do really have a distinctive appearance, though. Their head is entirely a yellowish-orange color, and then their abdomen has alternating black and kind of yellowish-orangish stripes on it, and then the thorax is black. So very contrasting colors on the body. We, of course, do have many native wasps around, but they're going to be much smaller when you think of our social wasps, such as yellow jackets and paper wasps, and even a creature we have that is our largest social wasp called the bald-faced hornet, which isn't technically a true hornet, by the way. It's actually a type of yellow jacket wasp. Those only get to be about maybe an inch or so long. So these Asian giant hornets are about double the size of our common social wasps here in the Midwest. Although I will say we do have a couple wasps around that folks might accidentally mistake for Asian giant hornets. And one that really comes to mind is a creature called a cicada killer wasp. And these will be popping out in about July when the cicadas start coming out. And they can be good size, maybe about an inch and a half or so long. But despite their large size, they're really harmless to people. The only thing they have interest in is hunting down cicadas. That's what they feed to their prey.
Yeah, and they look a lot different, I think, from the Asian giant hornet.
They do, yeah. And actually on my website, a couple of weeks back, I created a good infographic. So if any listeners are curious, if you head to the website for the UW Insect Diagnostic Lab, I've got an article posted that talks about the important points about this Asian giant hornet. But I also have a big graphic you can view on the screen, and you can look at this Asian giant hornet compared to a number of the common lookalikes that we bump into here in Wisconsin.
Yeah, we haven't seen them here in Wisconsin yet. Where are they being spotted?
So they've only been spotted in the Pacific Northwest. So some good news for Wisconsin listeners is the nearest sighting to us is about roughly 1,500 miles away. And one thing I'd like to point out about these Asian giant hornets, so we've seen a lot of news stories in the last month or so, but really all the action of the story was going on half a year ago or even longer than that. We're really talking about like last September. Scientists have only found one nest of this species in North America in a park on Vancouver Island, and they took that nest out and eradicated it last September. There were a few other sightings in nearby mainland British Columbia and nearby Washington State, far northwestern Washington State. But in 2020, this insect hasn't been spotted in North America. So we're just kind of, as a scientific community, waiting to see if it even survived the winter. And if so, scientists and folks monitoring the situation will really have until the fall to try and track down any additional nests.
And the murder hornet idea is not exactly correct, is it?
It's not. So when you read a lot of these articles about it, I kept seeing this number getting thrown out, saying that in its native range in Japan, for example, this insect was responsible for about 50 human deaths per year. And I kept seeing this number of 50 per year and was wondering where that came from. And several weeks ago, I was digging through the Japanese government public statistics website, where they have all kind of demographic information from mortality to birth rates, all that kind of good stuff. And you can actually really dig into the nitty-gritty details and find the numbers for this. And it turns out over the last decade, there have been about, on average, 18 deaths per year in Japan from a category they defined as hornets, wasps, and bees combined together. So some of those deaths would have been anaphylactic shock due to honeybee stings and things like that. So really the number I was finding was about 18 on average per year in the native range of Japan. In contrast, I saw in the statistics, just for comparative purposes, more people died slipping and falling in their own bathtubs, which we don't think of bathtubs as being scary, anything like that. So really the notion that these insects are murder hornets and are out to get humans is completely false. And so that seems kind of hyped up at this point.
Back to the cicada wasps for a minute. Chris in Adams is wondering if cicada wasps come back every year.
Well, in general, yes. If you tend to have them in your yard, you will tend to see them year to year. There may be some things that, might not necessarily lead to a repeat in a given year. But otherwise, what they do is they're emerging. The batch of adults in a given year are going to merge. They're going to be mating. They're going to be seeking out cicadas, which are the prey items they bring back to their nests in the ground and feed to their young. And so if they emerge from some nice sandy soil that was easy to dig in, there's a good chance they're going to come back to the same area. So when I see cases of those, folks often do tend to see them in their yard on a regular basis in kind of the same spots.
P.J. Leash, our guest today, he is the manager of the UW-Madison Insect Diagnostic Lab. Questions for him, give a call at 800-642-1234. Email at ideas@wpr.org. Dennis in Deerfield has a question for you. Let's go there. Hi, Dennis.
Hi. See, I've just moved to a new house and find I have a large, healthy American elm tree, which I thought were all killed by beetles a long time ago. I'm curious if that's still a problem. Is there a concern I should have? What do I look for?
Right. So the concern with the elm trees, and it's actually kind of a two-part story. There were certain insects involved, certain types of bark beetles. The big thing going on, though, there was actually a disease called Dutch elm disease. And so that's what went through decades ago and took out a lot of the big elms in cities like Milwaukee and other urban areas and out in the woods as well. That disease is still out there. So if you have concerns about the health of that elm tree, one suggestion I would have would be in general to chat with a local arborist and just, get in touch with them and perhaps have them out for a site visit just to assess the health of that tree so that they can keep a close eye on it over the course of time.
Yeah, as long as the tree isn't damaged, those elm bark beetles were spreading the disease, if I'm not mistaken, and they needed fresh wounds, do they not?
Right, yeah, and that's exactly right, Larry. So a lot of these bark beetles, they tend to prefer trees that are wounded or stressed. So if you have a tree that's, I kind of refer to as being happy and healthy and they're growing and chugging along nicely, these types of insects would tend to leave those alone. It would be the trees that were damaged in the storm or had recent pruning wounds or something like that that made them slightly more attractive to these particular insects.
Still, from Dennis's point of view, it would be good to get an arborist out there to take a look.
Yes, definitely.
Dennis, thanks so much for calling. Appreciate your call. Todd in De Pere will give you a chance now. Hi, Todd.
Good morning. Hi. I was wondering if you could tell me what I observed out in the woods. A couple weeks ago, I was admiring some marsh marigolds, and there in the water, I noticed a what appeared to be looked like a small pine cone, four or five of them, and they were moving, tumbling through the water, and I thought maybe there was current in the water, but I don't think there was, and I picked one up, and as I looked at it, it looked like a old dead leaf and woody material, twigs, a little bundle of it. This thing was about an inch long and maybe 3/8 of an inch wide. As I pulled the woody material and dead matter from this thing, inside was a little grayish pupa about 3/8 of an inch long. And again, they were tumbling. Somehow they could navigate and tumble through the water, but I don't know if they twitched their bodies or... I was just wondering what I saw.
Yeah, interesting observation. So my thought in this case, because you described the little case of organic debris, leaf matter and twigs and stuff like that, to me it sounds like you bumped into some type of caddis fly. And larvae of caddis flies will construct cases out of material in a given body of water. And there's a bunch of different caddis flies. Some prefer slower moving water, some prefer whitewater streams and locations like that. And the material they build their little cases out of will actually vary amongst the different types of caddis flies. So some use little tiny rocks and pebbles, some use more of leaves and sticks and things like that. So in some cases, from an entomologist point of view, you can actually look at the cases up close under the microscope and use that to narrow down the family of caddis fly in some situations. So it definitely sounds like a caddis fly with the cases you described.
Very cool. Thank you, Todd, for calling. Appreciate it. That's a very cool observation. Let's go to Liz in Wausau next. Hi, Liz.
Hi. Thank you for taking my call. I was wondering, I know the Zika, the mosquito that carries Zika, was still farther south, but I was wondering where it was at, and do we have anything coming up yet in Wisconsin?
So some good news on that front, which is that for us here in Wisconsin, Zika really isn't an issue. And when you look kind of nationwide and worldwide, Zika, we know, popped up about 5-ish years ago and got a lot of attention, and things have really kind of quieted down since then. There are two primary mosquito species that come to mind when I think of Zika virus. There's Aedes aegypti, the yellow fever mosquito, and then Aedes albopictus, the tiger mosquito. We technically have picked up Aedes albopictus in the state now for the last 3 years. The good news, however, is it's only been found in really specific locations, and we're talking about in these cases companies that basically sell specialized tires, like large tractor tires and things like that. And so if these tires had originated in, say, the southern U.S. and got shipped up here, you know, if you want to think of an item that's hard to shake all the water out of, it would be a tire. If you get water in there, you just turn it every which way and can't get all the water out. So the story we think is going on with these mosquitoes in Wisconsin is they're being introduced by tires. They're probably not surviving through the winter because we only find them in those very specific locations where more tires are being brought in. Even then, even though we're technically finding some of these mosquitoes in Wisconsin, the risk is still overall exceedingly low. So that's good news for us. You'd really have to have pretty big populations of these. When you look at Zika transmission in the continental U.S., there have really only been some very isolated spots where it's actually been transmitted by mosquitoes, and that'd be locations such as far southern Texas and far southern Florida. So for us, again, the risk in Wisconsin is exceedingly low for Zika.
There you go, Liz. Thanks so much for calling. While you were talking, I was thinking about water and mosquitoes. And I tell you what, if you've got an old tire laying around or any place where water collects and just sits there, you can have mosquitoes, right?
Oh, yeah. And that's often a really good suggestion I have for folks is kind of mosquito-proofing your own yard. Any little bit of water can potentially raise mosquitoes. This could even be something as small as the cap from a disposable water bottle. If that cap were flipped upside down and filled with water and a part of a fallen leaf or something like that, that may be enough to raise 10, 12 mosquitoes, potentially more. So you can go out in your yard and look for places like that old tire, or maybe a tire swing. Maybe you could drill a hole in it to drain the water out. But other locations as well, a clogged gutter, even if you have a tarp covering up a wood pile or a camper or something like that, if that tarp has a dip in it where water can pool and collect, that could be a potential mosquito breeding site. Bird baths, you want to change the water maybe about once or a week or so during the summer months. But any location where you've got standing water like that, you're absolutely right, Larry. You could potentially breed some mosquitoes there.
PJ Leash, our guest today from the UW-Madison Insect Diagnostic Lab. I'm Larry Mueller, Jill Nadeau, our producer, Tyler Ditter, our engineer, and you are listening to the Ideas Network. Taking a look at the world of insects today with our guest, PJ Leash from the UW-Madison Insect Diagnostic Lab. Larry Mueller here. Thanks for joining in today. Questions? Give a call, 800-642-1234, or email at ideas@wpr.org. Love to hear from you. Linda in Menominee emailed to ask, what purpose do ticks serve in nature?
Well, that's one that even though I've thought about for quite a while, you know, I can't think of a whole lot of positive things going on for ticks. From the point of view of, if we were thinking of, from the ticks' point of view, they're simply trying to mate and perpetuate their species. They don't seem to be a significant food source for any animals out there. If you look in the literature, there aren't a whole lot of things that parasitize or attack ticks. So from my point of view, I'm not aware of a whole lot of positive benefit that they have out in the ecosystem. They're just trying to do their own thing. But we do know they can have a lot of negative impacts, such as disease transmission, for example.
Yeah, not a whole lot going for them, as a matter of fact, in terms of how they benefit or don't benefit nature. So there we go. Jim in Muskego, it's your turn. Hi, Jim.
Good morning. I don't know if PJ had a chance to see the National Geographic article about the loss of insects worldwide. And I thought it was pretty significant in that they said that if insects disappeared from the world, say goodbye to the humans because they do so much for us. And he went into different descriptions about, you know, windshield effect. I know you've talked about that before, that you're not getting the splattered insects like we used to get years ago. And then measurements at different locations through many, many years where there just isn't the volume of insects anymore. And they even said with the loss of birds, that may be a cause from insect depletion. Any thoughts on that, PJ?
Yeah, so I'm glad you brought that up. I personally have not had a chance to view that National Geographic article. I think it's this May issue that was on the cover of it, insects and insect decline. So it is an important issue going on. You did mention some of the kind of anecdotal things that we've been having these rumblings for years that folks just were driving up north, not having to squeegee so many insects off the windshield. So there's those general observations. Part of the challenge with insects declines is that it's very hard to actually gather the data to actually demonstrate that. You basically need to have experiments set up and do them for long periods of time, for really decades, 10, 20, 30 years or longer. And it's very difficult to find funding to be able to do a research project like that. A lot of grants want to fund a project that's can be wrapped up inside of 2 to maybe 5-ish years in most situations. But I think it is a very important topic. When you chat about entomologists, we do hear lots about insect declines. I'm a believer that they are definitely going on, and we're all connected one way or another. So as the National Geographic article mentioned, you know, if all the insects disappeared, mankind is going to be in a world of hurt because we rely on insects for so many different things. That can be pollinating our crops, controlling other pest species out there. When you think about all the beneficial predatory and parasitic insects that are controlling some of the bad insects. You know, if those disappear, that might lead to increased crop pest outbreaks, for example. And then there's a lot of behind-the-scenes stuff that, as humans, we either may not notice or we just take for granted. I mean, if you think about the soil, we think of earthworms, you know, kind of churning things up and returning nutrients to soil. But there's an awful lot of that same kind of recycling activity that's done by insects. So I think that's a really key point from the National Geographic article, that if all the insects disappeared, life as we know it is going to become increasingly difficult and may not be feasible, just because we don't necessarily have the technology to replace some of these ecosystem services that the insects provide us. So it's scary. And you also mentioned that connection with songbirds, and that's being looked at very seriously now. Because we know that a lot of songbirds at one point in their life or another will rely on insects. So I think it's a good illustration of how nature is really connected with all these tiny interconnected moving parts.
Yeah. Jim, thank you so much for that comment and question. Let's take another call. Clyde in Denmark, it's your turn now. Hi, Clyde.
Hi, how are you doing?
Good. Appreciate the call.
I wanted to report and find out what you think about. We had an invasion of black ants in our old farmhouse this year. We've had them before, but this year there were about four times as many, and they stayed about twice as long. They started like in the middle of February and lasted almost to the end of April. Seemed like there were two different sizes. One was about a third of an inch long, and the other size was almost a half inch long. Big black ants, and they were just into everything. We tried three different kinds of bait poisons, but none of those are labeled whether they're sugary or whether they're starchy or whatever, and none of them seem to work.
Okay. And I'm curious, did you see any winged ants as well, or only wingless ants?
Only wingless ones.
Okay.
And it seemed like when it started to finally warm up and become a real spring, well, then they moved outside.
Okay. Well, so given the size and the coloration, I'm really suspicious that those would be carpenter ants. Because usually when someone tells me big black ants and you're describing that size range of a quarter inch on up to maybe half of an inch, that's a very strong indicator that they would be carpenter ants. Because you were seeing them starting in February, that's an indicator for me there's probably a nest somewhere in the home. Now, it may be in an inaccessible spot you can't get to, such as a wall void or some tucked away spot like that. If the nest were located outdoors, I wouldn't expect you to see activity till, well, right around this time of the year in spring when things start warming up. But if they're active in February, you know, that may be an indicator that there's a nest indoors. If you have a wood-burning fireplace, occasionally these can be brought in with firewood. But if you're seeing them from year to year in kind of the same locations, it makes me suspicious that there is a nest located somewhere. And the thing with carpenter ants is their life cycle can play out really slowly over the course of many, many years. And when they establish a new nest, you're probably not even going to notice it because it might only have a dozen or so workers in that first year. But by the time they're producing multiple size workers, larger major workers and smaller minor workers, that probably nest has probably been there for 3 to maybe 6-ish years. So in terms of dealing with them, you had mentioned the baits. And the problem with carpenter ants is they tend to be kind of picky eaters, if you think about it that way. A lot of the common baits that you or I can find at the hardware store, garden center, just don't work particularly well against them. There are some more professional grade baits that pest control folks would use, and technically the general public can order these. It's just you'd have to purchase them online, and there are certain websites that will sell these products. A lot of them are either a granular type product or a gel type product. But if you're trying to deal with carpenter ants with baits, you really need to find a bait product that's specifically formulated for them. I will also mention with carpenter ants and baits, baits can be successful, and we've seen this from research studies, but it can be a slow process. We know of some of our other baits that like sugar and stuff like that this time of the year, you can put out a bait and they may quiet down within a week or 2 weeks. But for carpenter ants, it can be a very long, drawn-out process that can take sometimes 10 to 12 weeks to really take care of that colony. So that's one consideration. Sometimes with carpenter ants, if they're in a hard-to-find spot or you just can't find a nest, that's really where I encourage folks to call in a pest control professional, because the pros have different techniques and products they can use to more get at those tucked-away nests.
Yeah, and aren't they feeding on kind of like rotting wood and so forth? Is that why they're in the house?
Yes. So there is some truth to that. They are often associated with damp, rotting, or decaying wood. Sometimes, though, in homes, they can be associated with other materials, such as that pink or blue foam board insulation. And if you think of the density of that, it's kind of this dense, foamy, spongy stuff. That's going to be similar to rotting wood. So sometimes they can get into locations like that. But one thing I mentioned to folks is if you're finding carpenter ants, you know, start doing some thorough detective work to look for any potential signs of water damage. And sometimes folks know right off the bat they've got a leaky window or a roof leak or something like that. That's where I would focus my attention there. They're not necessarily eating the wood. And what I mean by that is they're not getting nutrition from it. They can't digest it, but they will kind of dig out and excavate the wood to make a nesting cavity to hang out in.
There we go. Clyde, thank you so much for calling. Appreciate your call. Well, let's go to Helen next in Big Bend. Hi, Helen.
Hi. Listen, I have some silverfish, and I also have spiders. I understand spiders we should have in our houses, but I want to get rid of the silverfish. And do spiders eat silverfish?
Yeah, so your final question there, a lot of spiders are fairly generalized predators. We have different types that kind of build their webs and sit in it. And silverfish, I wouldn't necessarily expect to climb up into a web like that. But we have other spiders that are more of ground hunters. So they kind of wander around and hunt for prey. Those spiders, if they bumped into a silverfish, it wouldn't surprise me at all if they ate them. So they probably are preying upon silverfish to a certain extent. But in terms of dealing with the silverfish, some of the top things that pop into my mind would be managing the home environment for them. And what I'm getting at is the notion that silverfish require humidity. That's why we tend to see them in places such as basements where it's a little bit more damp. So if you can do things like run a dehumidifier, really get that humidity down, that can help in the long run because it's going to create conditions that are inhospitable towards them. So that'll make it harder for them to survive. They also can't reproduce terribly quickly. So one thing that can be very helpful is to purchase and use what are called glue board traps. And these don't contain any pesticide on them. They're simply either a plastic tray or cardstock with really sticky glue on it. And in the parts of your home where you're seeing the silverfish, you can put out these glue board traps. And if the silverfish touch them, they're going to get stuck to the glue. So that can trap and kill them that way. But also it can be useful as a monitoring tool over time, because if you put out a batch today and maybe 2 months from now, you collect those and put out a fresh new batch of glue board traps, you can kind of pick out population trends over time and see are the silverfish numbers staying even, that is, you're catching the same number every other month or over time, or are their numbers tapering off over time? So that can be a very useful approach. The final option, if you really have major issues with these, you can go to the hardware store and get like a home defense type spray that you can use around your house. You'd have to follow the directions, but you'd usually be applying these to like cracks and crevices, these tucked away hiding spots in basements and other spots in your home where you're seeing a lot of the silverfish. So those are kind of your range of options off the top of my head.
There you go, Helen. Thank you so much for calling. Appreciate it. Well, a listener emailed that they have shield bugs on grapes and hazelnuts. How can they be controlled organically?
Well, organically, okay. So we do know that with our stink bugs, and there are shield bugs as well, though we don't really have that many species of shield bugs, these can feed on a range of different fruit and nut crops. And if they're feeding directly on the developing fruit, that can cause some injury. On the conventional side of things, the commercial growers can use spray products that will protect the developing fruit for typically a couple of weeks at a time. Organically, that's going to be much harder to do because the organic products break down rather quickly. So if you have simply a small number of shrubs or plants that you're worried about protecting, a couple options might be very regular inspection of the plants, like every afternoon going out there and seeing what's present on the plants. You could even potentially take your hand, maybe put a white sheet down on the ground and kind of shake the plant and see if insects fall on there. And you could, step on those and squish them or spray them with soapy water, that sort of thing. In terms of organic sprays, things containing pyrethrins I'd expect to work against things like stink bugs, but those products have a very short period of residual activity, meaning that they're going to break down in sunlight within about a day or so. So if you want a complete protection, you'd have to spray very, very regularly. One other thing that might be a possibility, it's going to depend on the type of plant, how large it is, that sort of thing. But in theory, if you have the plants covered so that the stink bugs can't get to them, that might be a possibility. So you might potentially be able to use some type of fine mesh netting or covering. You'd have to wait until after the plants have been pollinated, if they're pollinated by insects, so that the fruit or nuts are developing. Then you could consider covering them to have a barrier so that the insects can get to them. So those are some of my thoughts off the top of my head.
And Nancy in Fremont emailed that she's having problems with no-see-ums in the lower level of her home. What can she do to keep them out? Is there an additional screen she can put over the pet-resistant screen she has now, or maybe a repellent?
Yeah, so that's a good question. I would really wonder if they are indeed no-see-ums. I mean, if they are no-see-ums, no-see-ums are really an outdoor insect. The larvae develop in marshy areas and locations like that. They are small enough, and we have some other small flies as well that are small enough they can fit through a lot of the mesh screens out there. So one possibility would either be keep the sliding door or window closed until they've kind of run their course and have dispersed. We're not seeing them so much for that part of the year. Otherwise, you could consider taking off the screens, replacing them with a finer mesh screen. But unfortunately, that's going to be an awful lot of work to do that.
You can join in, too. Give us an email at ideas@WPR.org. But let's go back to the phones. And Ron in La Crosse. Ron, hi. Thank you for calling. Ron, are you there? We lost Ron. Let's go to Lucy in Madison, then. Lucy, hello.
Hi. Hello?
Hi, what can we do for you?
Oh, I wanted to comment on ants. I've had really good luck with vacuuming the ants with my vacuum cleaner. We have a lower level that's basically a finished basement with a walkout back door. And we had ants in the downstairs bathroom for the longest time. And in some other areas, I would see them. There would be quite a few of them. I would squish them. And one night I was sick, so I happened to be up, and I was down there in the computer room, and I looked across the hall toward the bathroom, and there were ants swarming. There was a swarm of ants. Some of them had wings. I was just so freaked out. And I went and got the vacuum cleaner. I vacuumed them up. And for several days, I kept vacuuming and vacuuming. And finally, we never had them again. And then recently, I had a line of ants in the kitchen, and I started ants. Vacuuming them, and that's upstairs. I started vacuuming them, and I did that for about a week, and they're gone.
Wow. Well, PJ, comment.
Well, I mean, the vacuum does bring up a good notion that it's a chemical-free way. You can physically remove the ants. It would really depend on, I would say, the type of ant, the ant species you're dealing with, because there's
certain scenarios that might explain those observations quite well. I can think of certain ants that like to nest along your foundation, and they'll emerge in your basement or lower level for a couple of days, and then they'll disappear on their own, whether you vacuum or not. For ants that are maybe wandering inside, sometimes an ant colony will simply start foraging in another area. So it's an option, but I generally wouldn't expect that to eliminate the ants. Again, it's something you can do if you're seeing them around your house. You can suck them up. You could get them with scotch tape or something like that. But unless you get to the actual colony and eliminate the colony, which is the root of the problem, there's a chance the ants could keep coming.
Ah, there you go, Lucy. Thanks for calling. Appreciate it. Christina in Glenwood, it's your turn. Hi, Christina.
Hi, guys. Thank you. I'm a bird lover. I have a kaleidoscope of birds that I feed every day. And for those that enjoy them, I'd like to supplement their diet with mealworms. I'm hoping you can advise me about how to raise mealworms.
Raising mealworms.
Good question. So I have not done that myself, but I've read reports of folks doing that, and it sounds like it's not terribly labor intensive. My best suggestion at the moment would simply be to hop online and do some Google searching for that. Maybe search for terms such as raising mealworms and put the term university or extension after it. But that'd be my best advice for now. I have seen some pretty darn good guides online for how to do that. And there's probably some YouTube videos and that sort of thing. The cases I've seen, folks are usually doing it in like a plastic Tupperware tub. You just have to give them enough food, be it oats from oatmeal or some other food source. And you just kind of let them be and do their thing in there and you can raise it. You might have some escapees potentially if your container doesn't seal up pretty well. But my understanding is it's a fairly easy thing to do.
All right. There you go, Christina. Good luck with it. John in Toma, your turn. Hi, John.
Hi. Thanks for taking my call. Yeah, I had a question about how to get rid of fruit flies. I've been using like a can or a plastic container with a cellophane and a rubber band around it with a little bait in there, and then you poke a little hole right in the center, and they all go in there, and they can't figure out how to get back out. That's the best way I know without doing chemicals, but it doesn't seem to get rid of them all. I've taken away their food source, like the garbage can and food scraps and stuff like that. I put them all in the freezer until garbage day. I try to take their food away, but I still have a problem with them. I'll take my answer off the air.
All right. Thank you for calling.
So for indoor fruit flies, you can indeed make kind of a do-it-yourself trap using apple cider vinegar or similar things where you maybe cover it up with cellophane and poke holes in it. That isn't really going to eliminate the issue, though. What you're doing there, it's kind of like using a Band-Aid. Yeah, you're going to siphon some of the adults off the population, but unless you find where the source is and take care of the source, they're going to keep coming. So when someone has fruit flies in their house, that's my first and most important piece of advice is try and find the source. And the thing is, fruit flies, even though we call them fruit flies, they're not necessarily associated with fruit. They can really be associated with any type of damp organic material. So that could even be some produce in storage. You know, if you have potatoes or onions that are kind of tucked away in a cool spot, if those started to go bad, you could raise an awful lot of fruit flies off that. Could be gunk that built up in a drain or garbage disposal, spilled garbage outside of a can or outside of a liner, anything like that could potentially raise some of these. So even though it sounds like in this case the garbage has been kind of taken care of, I would start expanding my search radius because there's got to be some source of damp food for them somewhere because they need organic material to feed on and they need moisture. Those are the two things they need to really survive and thrive.
And thanks so much for that call. PJ Leash, our guest from the UW-Madison Insect Diagnostic Lab. I'm Larry Mueller, and you are listening to the Ideas Network. Taking a look at the world of insects today with our guest PJ Leash from the UW-Madison Insect Diagnostic Lab. I'm Larry Mueller. Thanks so much for joining in. Questions about insects, give us a call at 1-800-642-1234, or you can email us at ideas@wpr.org. Love to hear from you, and we have open lines, and we'll get you on pretty quickly. We have a question from Wayne in Wales, Wisconsin. He has repeated nesting of cicada wasps in his yard. They're pretty scary, but he understands they're beneficial insects. Doesn't want to kill them necessarily, but how does he get them to move from his yard?
Yes, unfortunately, that's going to be tricky to do. When I see the cicada wasps, they tend to like to nest in soil that's easier to dig in. So if you have part of your yard with heavier soil versus maybe a spot that's sunny and dry, or maybe it's got soil that's a little bit sandier, they find a spot like that, and they just like to set up shop because it's good habitat for them to build their nests in. In theory, if you were to kind of redo the soil in your yard, bring in different soil, that may be enough to change the environment. You could try, this would be kind of a long drawn out process. If you were to keep disturbing and filling in their nests, that may encourage them to kind of go elsewhere potentially. I've even heard of folks getting some very fine mesh and basically covering up those holes. So if you're to watch the holes when they leave, you can cover up, because these cicada killer wasps have individual nests. So when one of them leaves their ground nest, you could cover it up and fill it in. And when they come back, if they can't find their nest, perhaps that may dissuade them. So there's no magical bullet to just get them to up and move really fast. It may be kind of a slow process of kind of over the course of time dissuading them.
Marilyn emailed that she sees lots of bumblebees this year after hardly seeing any the last few years. Might that be because of the wet weather in those past years? Also, when those little bumblebees are crawling around on Creeping Charlie or even in the lawn and not stopping on flowers, what are they looking for? They often go down under the leaves.
Yeah, so with the bumblebees, I've been really pleasantly surprised this year. I have seen just tons of bumblebees, which is great to see and great
to
see.
Yeah, I have too.
Other folks are. Yeah. Last year at this time, I was getting the opposite situation. I was getting folks calling me saying, "Where are the bumblebees?" And I kept telling them they're out there, and they eventually kind of picked up over the course of the year. But this year compared to last year, very, very different. In terms of what they're doing, I mean, bumblebees will go for just about any type of nectar and pollen source. So for us, we may call things like Creeping Charlie a weed, but for them, that could be breakfast, lunch, and dinner. So I suspect they may be investigating some of these other weedy plants in yards. In other cases, if they're just digging around, I wonder if you may be seeing queens that are looking for a nesting site for the year and they just haven't set up shop yet. So the way that bumblebees complete their life cycle, they overwinter as fertilized queens. Those queens emerge in spring, and they've got to do all the work at first, establish a nest, raise that first batch of workers. And then once she has enough workers to take off and do the work for, then she stays at home at that point. So I wonder if they're out doing some foraging, but also looking for nesting sites.
Let's take another call. Steve in Antioch, your turn. Hi, Steve.
Yes. How you doing, guys?
Good. Appreciate the call.
All righty. I got a problem with beetles. They're maybe a quarter of an inch long. They're black with a brown stripe in the middle. Do you guys know what those are?
So to me, that sounds like a creature I would call a larder beetle. And those fit the description perfectly, about a quarter of an inch long, blackish, but they just have this brown band kind of cutting across the middle of their body. And the story with these is the larvae develop on protein-rich materials. So that can include things such as rodent fur. If you have like a dead mouse somewhere or a dead bird somewhere, they can feed on the feathers. They can also survive indoors on human or pet foods in some cases. But also another thing about these is this time of the year, because you can have larder beetles outdoors, they can overwinter beneath the bark of dead trees and stuff like that. But this time of the year, larder beetles can try migrating into a home from outside. So you could potentially see them clinging to your window screens and things like that. So kind of these two different scenarios, if they only seem to be coming in from outside, I would make sure your window screens are in good shape and sealing up well, that sort of thing. But if you're seeing them around the house, I would first of all look for like a dead mouse somewhere, because even if it's old and dried out and mummified, they really like those. They'll feed on the fur, they'll feed on kind of the dried out sinews and materials like that. But I'd also start looking at people and pet food. They can feed on dead insects. So if your home historically has a history of box elder bugs and Asian lady beetles sneaking indoors in the fall, in theory, if you have a bunch of dead insects under your siding or in a wall void or soffit area, they could potentially feed on that as a food source. So sometimes the food source is really tucked away and inaccessible. If you do have access to the internet, if you go to the UW Extension horticulture website, which is hort.uwex.edu, we do have a University of Wisconsin-Madison Extension fact sheet on that larder beetle, which has a bunch more information about its biology and how to deal with it.
There you go, Steve. Thank you so much for calling. Let's go to Carl in Eagle River. Hi, Carl.
Yes, I have problems with apples not developing right. They get all crippled up, and I was told that they were the rosy apple aphid. I'd like to know how to get rid of those. I've tried a number of things, and nothing's worked so far.
Okay. So you're simply seeing that the fruit are really distorted at harvest time?
I've even noticed that even as the fruit develops a quarter of an inch, it's got like a spot on it already. And it's kind of misformed when it's very, very tiny. So it's not even a large apple yet. It's just the petals have fallen off, the fruit's developing, and I can see already that it's got these spots on and that it's not uniform shaped, and then it gets worse as it gets bigger.
Okay. Well, I mean, off the top of my head, rosy apple aphid probably wouldn't have popped into my head as getting into my top list of suspects. We do get aphids on apples. I think of them as causing a lot of distortion and curling to leaves and things like that. But aphids, they're not particularly mobile. So you would see them on those plant tissues that they're feeding on for the most part. We do have a number of other insects, though, that can attack the fruit directly. So just after the fruits have started developing, there are things like plum curculio, and there are other possibilities as well. But unless we know the exact insect pest, it's hard to give you the best information in terms of what to do about it. So what I would suggest at this point is if you start seeing the distortion on those fruit this year, what you'd be welcome to do is collect some of those fruit, and you can mail those into me at the UW Insect Diagnostic Lab. I can then examine them up close and see, because sometimes there are very distinctive signs that will indicate if it's one insect or a different insect. And then once we know what the pest is, then we can figure out exactly what you should do about it.
Makes good sense. And the UW Insect Diagnostic Lab, you just type that into your search engine. I think that's going to pop up for sure, Carl. Thank you so much.
Yep.
Yep. Thanks so much for calling. And Chris in Appleton, hi.
Good morning, guys. I just have an old log cabin, and I see these little piles of sawdust on the bottom, so I'm thinking it's powder post beetles. What would be a good way to get rid of those if that's what it is?
Okay, and the sawdust, this is something that has been occurring fairly recently. You notice this little pile showing up?
Yeah, we bought the property, and the cabin's been empty. It was built in the 30s, and we kind of swept out all the sawdust, and it keeps recurring. Little piles of it around on the floor.
Okay, gotcha. Yeah, I mean, that does sound like a classic case for powder post beetles. I think of powder post beetles when I think of old cabins, old barn wood, and that sort of thing. There are some products that can help manage these. The challenge is it can potentially be a lot of work. If you were building a log cabin, one of the products that might be used would be a borate type wood preservative. There are a number of products out there. Timbor is one of them, T-I-M-B-O-R. There's Boracare, which I believe is B-O-R-A-C-A-R-E. And these are borate-based wood preservatives that you can basically paint on or roll on, or in some cases even spray onto the wood. It's going to soak into the wood a little bit, and that's going to serve as a long-term protection from insects like this and other things as well. Some challenges, though, is that if the wood has been painted or varnished or sealed or something like that, these products won't be able to wick into the wood. So that would involve basically stripping off all the paint and other things. You'd have to then apply these borate products, and then when you're done, repaint or reseal everything up. So it can be a very, very long process to do something like this. If the wood isn't sealed or painted at all, then it's much easier to do, but it can be kind of a long process to do.
There you go. Thank you so much, Chris, for calling. A little work ahead of you perhaps there. BJ Leash, who is the manager of the Insect Diagnostic Lab at UW-Madison, our guest, and with us up until 12:30. We'll take a quick look at the news, and then we'll be back with PJ. You stay with us. I'm Larry Mueller for the Ideas Network. Taking a look at the world of insects today on the Ideas Network, Larry Mueller here with my guest, PJ Leash. Back with us again, he's manager of the UW-Madison Insect Diagnostic Lab. Have you seen an unusual bug? What questions do you have for PJ? Give a call at 800-642-1234, or you can send us an email to ideas@wpr.org. And some callers online, PJ, so let's turn to the phones and to Steve in Spring Valley. Hi, Steve.
Hello. I've been receiving mailers and hearing ads for places that want to spray the lawn for mosquitoes and grubs and things like that. I'm wondering, is that really necessary, or does it even do damage to other insects, pollinators, and birds?
Yeah, great question. And for both of those types of applications, there are concerns for other insects out there. So if we think about the mosquito treatments, for example, the mosquito treatments that are commonly used, they're going to use an insecticide from the pyrethroid class. And these are technically based on some natural chemicals found in certain types of chrysanthemums, which we'd call the pyrethrins or pyrethrum. But the natural extract breaks down really quickly in sunlight, like within a day. So chemists tweak the molecules to make them last longer, usually a couple weeks. So these pyrethroids, yes, they can kill mosquitoes, but they're very, very broad spectrum, meaning they can kill all kinds of other insects. So it's one thing if in your yard you're treating one bush or one plant in your garden, for example. But if you have a mosquito treatment where they end up going around your entire yard, spraying every shrub and plant in your yard, for example, yes, if mosquitoes land on that, it's going to impact them. But other insects that land on there could also be impacted. That could be bees. That could be things like fireflies, which we know fireflies like to land on plants to, you know, flash for the mating purposes. That could also include things like butterflies, beneficial pollinating beetles and things like that. There was a study several years ago that looked at mosquito treatments and found out that they could have negative impacts on monarch caterpillars. So if someone is spraying a mosquito yard treatment and those products drift onto, say, nearby milkweed, you know, then that can have some significant impacts on monarch caterpillars developing there. So, yes, there can be some side effects of these treatments, especially if you're applying them very regularly throughout the season to a very large portion of your yard rather than individual plants. With the grub treatments and lawns. You know, in a lot of cases, it really depends on your personal preference for the lawn. If you're really particular about your lawn and you really want that lush, green, dense lawn and you're worried about grubs, you know, then it can make sense. Or every single year you see grub injury, you know, then that might be a case where it makes more sense to use one of those products. But in a lot of situations, if you have a lawn that is happy and healthy, so to speak, you can tolerate quite a few grubs. If you've got a healthy lawn, you can easily get 10 to 12 Japanese beetle grubs per square foot, and you may never even know. So when you think about it that way, most folks in the state probably have some grubs in their lawn, and they just never know about it because it doesn't show any damage. Now, if the grub numbers are really high, yes, you can start seeing some brown patches and turf grass death in your lawn, that sort of thing. So for grub control, there'd really be kind of two approaches to that. One would be a preventative approach where you'd apply the product ahead of time. But the caveat is you don't know how bad the beetles, Japanese beetles or May, June beetles, will be in a given year versus kind of a curative or corrective approach. This would be later on in the season, maybe September, October, you notice you have grubs and causing some damage, and you might decide to treat at that point. So there are some different approaches you can take. We do have concerns with some of those grub control treatments potentially posing risk to pollinators. And what I'm getting at there is in particular, if you have weeds in your lawn, to us, we may call dandelion and clover and even things like creeping Charlie weeds, but those are flowering plants, and bees and other pollinators could go to those plants for nectar and pollen. And so if these grub treatments are applied to that, that might pose some risk there. Now, there are ways that you can minimize those risks. One very simple thing is if before applying these products to a home lawn, you go through and you simply mow the lawn. That's going to clip off the flower heads from the dandelions and other things, and that can help reduce risks. But again, there's always some risks out there, both with the mosquito treatments and also with the grub treatments.
All right, there you go. Diane in New Berlin has a question. Let's go there. Hi, Diane.
Hi, how are you?
Good, appreciate the call.
Yeah, okay, I have a strange question. Just the opposite of what everybody else is concerned with. I have pawpaw trees that need to be pollinated by flies. And I have such a hard time, right? Occasionally we'll try to hand pollinate, but of course, if I could get the flies to do it, that would be awesome. I am trying to attract flies to my trees. Any suggestions?
Well, that's a tough question. I am not very familiar with pawpaw plants because as far as I'm aware, I think those grow more to the east of us, if I remember correctly. So I don't know a whole lot about the pollination of those plants in particular. In general, though, when you say you want to attract flies, that's a pretty loaded question because we've got probably a couple thousand species of flies in the state. If we knew more of a specific species or even a family of flies, that could maybe point you in the right direction for that. Otherwise, I mean, most yards are going to have an awful lot of flies out there.
Yeah.
I would suspect in a given yard, if you went and surveyed, you could probably at least find 10 to maybe even 25 different families of flies out there, from mosquitoes to house flies to blowflies and so on. So in my mind, there's an awful lot of flies out there already.
So if it's a particular fly, I guess we'd have to know which fly is the one that pollinates the pawpaw trees.
Yeah, what I would suggest at this point, if the caller were to shoot me an email, and if you go to the website for the UW Insect Diagnostic Lab, I've got all my contact information there. And if you shoot me an email, I can do a little bit more digging and see what we can come up with in this case, because it's definitely a unique case. I can't say I've bumped into pawpaw plants here in Wisconsin before.
All right, there we go, Diane. So just go to the UW Insect Diagnostic Lab and you'll see how to contact PJ. Barbara in Fort Atkinson, we'll go to you now. Hi, Barbara.
Hi, thank you for taking my call.
Sure.
I have been finding these gray round beetles in my house that are, they're real rounded, and they don't seem to bite, but they're very scary when you come upon one in an unusual place. So I just wondered if I've never seen them before. It's just this spring, and it seems like they're dropping from my ceiling, I think. I'm not sure.
Okay, and when you say that they're round, are they always round, like curled up like a pea or something like that, or are they sometimes flat?
No, they're not. They're flat on the bottom. Their shell on the outside is rounded to oval-shaped. And they're pretty okay. good size. They're about an inch in diameter.
Okay. Well, interesting. In this case, if you're able to get me either some pictures of the creature, that would really help me narrow down. I'm trying to think, and I can think of a couple potential possibilities. Or if you can collect one or a couple of these things and mail them in to me at the UW Insect Diagnostic Lab, then I can tell you exactly what they are, and that'll give us an idea of what they may be up to. I wonder a little bit, given that they're an inch long, if they might be something like a millipede. And with the damp conditions we've had the last couple years, it wouldn't surprise me if I start getting a lot of millipede calls in the near future. Originally, I was thinking of things like pill bugs, which can curl up into a very tight spherical shape, but they're usually only maybe half an inch long or so. But millipedes can be about an inch long. So I wonder if that might be it.
Could be it, but otherwise send a photo or a sample to the Insect Diagnostic Lab and you'll get an exact answer from PJ Leash. There you go, Barbara. Thank you. Ron in La Crosse, your turn. Hi, Ron.
Yeah, I go back to the 1950s here in La Crosse County. And of course, we're near the Mississippi, and in the summer, there'd be so many flying insects, dragonflies, moths, and everything. The local auto parts stores used to sell these screens. You put them in front of your car grills to prevent unsightly grill kill. Of course, what would happen is the screen itself became unsightly from all the bugs. So it was sort of a half measure.
Yeah, I can kind of remember those times as well. PJ, you're a little too young for that, maybe, but... You remember those times?
Well, I've read plenty about them, and I know over the years, you know, many folks have called into your show and mentioned how they drive from southern Wisconsin and go up to Bayfield County or somewhere else in Northwoods, and they have to stop twice and squeegee off their windshield, that sort of thing. And we just don't hear as many reports about that anymore. I do also remember as an entomology student hearing in some of the textbooks that you get these massive emergences, and we still see this to a certain extent with mayflies along the Mississippi, but sometimes you'd get these and they just have to take the snow plows out and clear the roads. But we don't hear as much these days about folks having to clear off their car because of all the insects they're smacking into.
Yeah. Ron, thank you. Let's go to Jenny in Green Bay next. Hi, Jenny.
Hi. Thanks for taking my call. The show has been really helpful so far today alone. I have a situation in my backyard. I have to take down some trees because, well, emerald ash borer, and they're all ash trees. And the reason I want to ask is we're thinking about filling in some of the backyard. It's very low. I had a big lake the other week with all the rain we got. And it's just terrible for mosquitoes. We're by a heavily wooded area and stream, and it's for sure a lot of mosquito habitat. So I'm wondering, is it even worth my time to try to fill in some of that low area in my backyard? Will that help me with the mosquitoes, or should I just deal with it and get a lot of citronella plants?
What do you think, BJ?
Yeah, I mean, in theory, if you can eliminate all that standing water, that may help to a certain extent, but there's a lot of factors in a case like this. And one thing I'd wonder about is how big of an area are we talking about? And if it's water that's, you know, permanent, something along those lines, if it were like a swampy area, you know, then I wonder, do you need permits from the DNR or, you know, something along those lines to even do that type of thing? But again, in theory, if you eliminated the standing water, that should help with mosquitoes. There are some other options out there as well. There are some treatments, even organic options, that can be applied to standing water. There are products out there that contain a type of bacteria, Bacillus thuringiensis, products like mosquito dunks and granules and so on that can be applied. And these are bacteria that happen to be only toxic to the larvae of flies, such as mosquitoes. So that might be an option as well. In the grand scheme of things, though, you might fill in every bit of standing water in your yard, but depending on the mosquito species in your area, that may have the overall upper hand. And what I'm getting at is certain mosquito species are simply capable of flying extremely long distances. In some cases, it could be 5 to 10 to maybe even 20 miles from their source if the wind is blowing in your direction. So with that said, I'd hate to have you put in all this effort and then you still have a bunch of floodwater mosquitoes coming in and it may seem like it isn't making a difference. So to really answer that question, you'd almost have to survey mosquitoes ahead of time, know your species, and then after the fact, see if there's differences there to know if it really made much of an impact.
There you go, Jenny. Thank you so much for calling. Appreciate it. I want to go back to the pawpaw trees and the flies that the person needed to have attracted to her pawpaw trees. Liz Freemuth, a good friend and a regular guest on this program. She's a horticulturist, landscaper, and she emailed to say to that caller, put a dead fish under the pawpaw. It attracts the right flies. So there you go.
Oh. Interesting,
Liz, thank
yeah.
you. Liz should know that. She's had a lot of, I think, had a lot of experience with pawpaw trees. So a dead fish under the pawpaw attracts the right flies. Who'd have known? Who'd have thunk it? Nan and Mozanie, your turn. Hi, Nan.
Hi, Larry. Hi, PJ. I have a problem with mites on my delphiniums, and I'd like to know when to start to spray, how often, and what would be best to use.
Okay, so when I think of delphiniums and mites, in a case like this, I'd say it'd be really helpful to get a sample in to me so we can figure out the type of mite. Reason I'm saying that is when I think of common plant mites outdoors, there are things like spider mites, which are relatively easy to control if you have small plants with things like insecticidal soap, versus other types of mites like broader cyclamen mites and other types as well that can be much more challenging. And then you're talking about some pretty expensive products that would even be used to control those. So until we know the exact type of mite you're dealing with, I can't really narrow down a specific management approach for you.
Ah, there we go, Dan. Thank you. PJ, you should have some photos that were sent to you, Jill sent to you, of some bugs. Do you have those up by any chance?
I do, yes.
Yeah, Helen emailed a photo of some bugs that are in a friend's house by the hundreds and wonders what they are.
Yeah, so what we're talking about in this case, I can see in the photo that the listener had sent in, these are types of ground beetles. So they're these oval-shaped beetles, maybe about a quarter inch long or slightly under that size. Some of these can be associated with crops and farm fields in some settings, and they can be strongly attracted to lights at night. So I wonder in this case, if there had been a lot of these flying around in a given night, and I've seen this myself when I've done black light trapping in rural areas, you turn on the black light trap and within 5 minutes you can get 2,000 of these beetles showing up and you kind of give up for the night because there's so many of them. So these are insects that would have originated outdoors. They must have snuck in somehow. If they were being attracted to lights, I would maybe suggest keeping some more lights off or closing the shades. Sometimes these may be very active for a couple days or a week or two, and then they kind of run their course and they're not as active. We also have some ground beetles, though, that will wander around on the ground at night, and they may be feeding on other insects, or some will feed on seeds and things like that. But they must be sneaking in through a gap around a window or door frame. Maybe the weather stripping needs to be checked, but they're a type of ground beetle that this listener sent in, Larry.
And Mark had emailed a kind of a pretty photo of a bee wondering if on a dandelion, wondering if it's a rusty patch bee.
Well, it's not the rusty patch bee. In the photo that was sent in, it's definitely a bumblebee. We see the large size. It looks like it's on a dandelion. Very fuzzy appearance with black and yellow. And then there's also some very distinctive rusty color on the abdomen of this particular bee. And it turns out we actually have multiple different species of bumblebees in Wisconsin that can have this rusty orange color. Now, the thing with the rusty patch bumblebee, and that's the one you've maybe heard about in the news over the last couple of years, because that bumblebee species is endangered. The rusty patch bumblebee has some rusty coloration, but it's just a teeny tiny little blip of this orangish reddish color on the second abdominal segment. In this particular bumblebee, we see two entire abdominal segments covered with that orange color. So in this case, it's a species that's very common. We call the tricolored bumblebee.
It's very pretty indeed. David in Madison, do you have a question?
Yeah, hi. Hello?
Yes, what can we do for you?
Okay, just after the hour, you had a call about large round / oval bugs. I'm betting those are stink bugs. And I've got them, or my wife complains that we have them in the house here, too.
So stink bugs. Any comment on that, PJ?
Yeah, so that could be a possibility as well. I when I heard the original description as round or oval, I wasn't quite thinking stink bugs. Stink bugs, if you look at them from a top-down view, they usually have a fairly distinctive shield-shaped body to them. However, we do get certain stink bugs, like the non-native brown marmorated stink bug that likes to sneak indoors into homes. However, brown marmorated stink bugs, if you measure them, they tend to be just over a half inch long. And I believe that other caller had mentioned they're about an inch long. So I'll hopefully get some photos from them and be able to narrow it down. But we do definitely have some stink bugs that sneak indoors. And unfortunately, Madison area, we seem to be the epicenter for this brown marmorated stink bug in the state. So I know a lot of folks in Dane County have been seeing these over the winter months and outdoors. We're seeing some outside on yard plants at the moment, too.
Yeah, and getting rid of them, not much to be done with that, is there?
Well, if they're indoors, probably the best thing, what I do if I see a lone stink bug here or there in my house, I grab it with a tissue or napkin or piece of paper towel or something like that. And the reason I do that is if you squish them, they do have a very pungent odor associated with them. And if you get that on your skin, I swear you can wash your hands three times and it's still kind of on there. So grab it with a tissue. If for some reason you looked up behind the curtains and you had two dozen of these stink bugs, then I would be more inclined to take the hose attachment on the vacuum cleaner and suck them up that way. Otherwise, looking at the bigger picture, if you have stink bugs in your house, especially during the winter months and in the spring, they really snuck in last fall. So the place to draw the line in the sand would be to seal things up, prevent them from getting in the fall. That would prevent issues during the spring and winter months.
PJ, always a pleasure. Thanks so much for being with us today. Look forward to your next visit on July 15th. Thanks, PJ.
Sure thing.
PJ Leish, who manages the UW-Madison Insect Diagnostic Lab. Tomorrow we take a look at some COVID-19 scams on the program, so stay with us, tune in for that. And stay with us, lots more in store on the Ideas Network. I'm Larry Mueller.